Good morning, Richard, and this is KLOILP, Lopez Island, Washington, 102.9 FM. And how are you today?
Just fine. Great. Thank you.
It's good to see you on this slightly cloudy morning. This program, when you hear it, was pre-recorded. You'll be hearing this program the first Monday November.
I think it's the second.
Second Monday. Yeah.
No, I mean, I think the,
date is the second,
okay. I believe.
Yeah, it looks like you're right about that, looking at the October calendar. So November 2nd, you'll be hearing this at 10 o'clock in the morning. Is that when it... 11.
11, I believe.
Yeah, 11. Sorry, I'm a little... you'll be hearing this at 11 o'clock on November 2nd. Halloween will have passed. Just recently, the candy jars are still full. So, I would also like to say, I think, Richard, you said we had about 20...
Yeah, this is... Well, we sort of collapsed the last two. We had intended 20, so that, there's now going to be 19, because I've collapsed 19 and 20. They seem to go together so well that I thought we'd make it maybe a little longer and collapse these two.
Okay, so this... we've started, almost a year ago.
Almost a year ago, yes, after the first of the year.
And, this is Richard Fagan with A Strange and Wonderful World. I forgot to tell you the name of the program. And we're chatting about how many programs have been recorded so far. And I think this will be the 19th you're listening to. And Richard, this will be the last program for an indeterminate length of time. We don't know if he'll be back, or he may do one occasionally, or this may be it. But you'll still be hearing... for the following year, we're going to rerun Richard Fagan's previous programs sequentially, because they're kind of organized that way in their presentation at the same time slot. So you'll still get to hear Richard Fagan and all the episodes that you might have missed. And also, just a reminder, these programs are archived on the KLOI.org website, and you can go to them and put them on your iPod and listen to them while you walk, like Iris does, and or listen to them whenever you want to. So where are you taking us today?
Well, you know, we started out quite a while ago in the Pacific, and we crossed the Pacific. We were with Captain Bligh and a mutiny and Polynesian navigation, and out in paradise with some enchanted evening. And we've made our way to New England, and now it's time to cross the Atlantic Ocean and to get to Europe. But we're going to cross it not on the Queen Mary. We're going to cross it on two tiny craft, both of which were epic voyages after the Second World War. And I was going to treat them as two separate programs, but they go so well together, they're dramatically different in terms of the kind of voyage it was, that I decided to juxtapose them. So this may run a little longer.
Okay.
And also, I wanted to take just a minute at the very start, Carol, to thank you. You've been a wonderful host. It's been a delight working with you. This is a new experience for me to do this. I've done a lot of radio programs, but they were all separate. They were just, you know, kinds of breaking news things, talking head kinds of things, but this is the first time I've done a series of programs, and it's really been quite wonderful. I've enjoyed it very much, so thank you.
Oh, you're welcome, Richard, and I'm say goodbye with I will miss our times together.
Yes, me too. Well, the first of these two voyages was by an Australian by the name of Ben Carlin, spelled C-A-R-L-I-N, and I'm going to start with a short quotation from Carlin, which gives you a sense of what kind of guy he was and what kind of trip this trip was. It's the 19th of July in 1950, and we're just off Halifax Harbor in Nova Scotia. And out at sea is an amphibious jeep. We'll talk a little later about what this thing was. And Ben Carlin and his American wife, Eleanor, have set sail in this thing across the Atlantic. The jeep is named Half Safe, which is something of an exaggeration because it was less than half safe. And poor Eleanor is already hopelessly seasick. So here's Carlin writing at the beginning of his book, which is also titled Half Safe. This is Carlin's voice. We puttered away all afternoon and evening on a course of 135 degrees. Eleanor was hopelessly seasick. I couldn't keep my eyes open and shut down for sleep. Half Safe drifted. While they're drifting, they're visited by a school of porpoises, and he picks up the story again. Less entertaining was the discovery that our main water supply was brackish. The main water tank was strapped across the transom and constantly awash. When last I filled it before leaving, I'd forgotten to tighten the screw plug.
Oh, were I his wife.
Now, who were these people? And what were they sailing in? And one has to use the word sailing in its almost metaphorical meaning. Well, as I said, Ben Carlin was an Australian. He was born in 1912, and he was schooled in Perth in Western Australia. He served in the Royal Indian Engineers in World War II, and at the war's end, when he was being mustered out, he laid his eyes on an American-built amphibious jeep, and he fell in love with the thing. Already a strange love affair. Let's take a moment to familiarize ourselves with this jeep because, of course, we're all familiar with the regular terrestrial jeep, played such a big role both during and after the Second World War. Now, this jeep had a very interesting patrimony, this seagoing jeep, because it was designed by Roderick Stevens. Those of you who know something about yachting will recognize the name Sparkman and Stevens. This is one of the premier yacht design firms in the country and in the world during this period. And he had designed, Roderick Stevens had designed the duck, which many of us are familiar with because there are these DUKWs that you can still see them in Seattle. They take tourists out into Puget Sound and then rumble around the street. They look like huge overgrown jeeps. So this was the baby sister of the duck, designed by the same guy, and it was actually known as a SEAP, which has a nice sort of ironic ring to it, but that stands for Sea Jeep, and it was a total failure as a vehicle because it was heavy, and of course it was small. We all know the size of a jeep, and it only had about 6 inches of freeboard. So when you took this thing out in the most minimal chop, like out in Fish Bay, they sank. They filled up with water and they sank.
Seeps. They didn't seep, really. They
just
sank. Yeah,
they just seeped. They sank. Right. In the words of one report, and this is a report on the seep after the war, many of the seeps that were used in battle sank if there were any significant waves at all. So it basically played no important part in World War II except a lesson learned. But Ben Carlin didn't feel that way about it. Anyway, after the war, he went from India to the United States and had many adventures trying to buy a surplus seep or sea jeep. He was, of course, non-American, and so he wasn't eligible to buy American war surplus. He got a surrogate buyer, etc. Anyway, he finally found one in marginal condition, bought it for $900.
It was in marginal condition when it was new, it sounds like.
Well, he at least realized that it was completely inappropriate for what he had in mind, which was to cross the Atlantic and then cross it to Africa. Then he intended to drive the thing up to Europe, across Asia, out into the islands, probably Japan, eventually across the Bering Strait, into the United States, and then back to where he started from in Canada. So he was going to go around the world in this thing, on land and in sea. So he had the jeep, the seep. He was in the United States, and he knew that it needed a lot of work in order to put it in seagoing condition. And because he didn't have much money and prices were high in the yacht yards, he undertook the work himself. It turns out he was an excellent, excellent mechanic, which is very good. And he made a huge number of changes to this vehicle, for living aboard, for navigation, for propulsion, for water tightness, fuel storage, and supply. Most critical, of course, was building it up into some kind of enclosed capsule so that if waves broke over it, they would just, in fact, run back into the sea. In other words, sort of a surface submarine.
Right.
So finally he gets all of this done, and he straps onto the belly of it, because fuel's a problem in this thing crossing the Atlantic. It's very tiny, and it had, what, maybe a 15, 20-gallon tank on it. So he straps on a huge 300 and about 25-gallon belly tank underneath it, and he launches it in New York Harbor. Well, actually, he launched it down near Annapolis and was going to sail to New York Harbor, and it's not long before he's immediately in trouble. And here is his voice again. On the second morning, with the wind moderate, I cast off and idled near the end of the breakwater. This is Annapolis, awaiting the imminent turn of the tide. As I sat at the wheel, quite suddenly I was physically stunned. Instinctively, I reached for the ignition switch, but my fingers wouldn't turn it. Leaving it, I half rolled, half crawled through the hatch, collapsed in a helpless sprawl on the cabin top. In China, before the war, I was poisoned by carbon monoxide and only just got away with it. So this time I didn't have to think twice to recognize the sudden galloping pulse, dizziness, and loss of muscular control. Now, he can't control the Jeep because he's on the cabin top. He's outside, and the Jeep starts to turn in circles while he tries to recover his sanity, really. And he writes, every time it came in sight, he's talking about a breakwater, it was obviously closer than before. The dying tidal set was carrying the circling Jeep toward the breakwater, but also out and maybe around it. As the breakwater came into view for what might be the last time, it was a toss-up whether we would collide or not. If we missed this time, the Jeep's next circle would carry her clear past the land of the breakwater, the end of the breakwater, into open water and safety. Before the hit or miss, the breakwater swung out of sight, and blind, I waited for the result. No luck. Clunk. We had struck hard, and it was metal on metal. Fortunately for him, the rebar, which was sticking out of the breakwater, went through his water tank, and it didn't sink the Jeep, because the water tank was independent of the Jeep. Anyway, typical of his early adventures. He finally reaches New York in May of 48, and in preparation for a honeymoon at sea, he marries Eleanor. Now, Eleanor's an American whom he met over in India. She was with the USO, and they've been going around together. She obviously had high tolerance for
a
this
honeymoon. It was I thought maybe they'd been married for
anyway. Yeah, so he's going to have his honeymoon at sea with Eleanor. So on June 16th, they set sail. Eleanor is seasick. The Seep won't steer properly. The belly tank is banging against the hull. They go back to shore. They repair, or he repairs. They cast off. They're forced back again. On the third try, an exhaust system failure forces them back. On the fourth try, a drive shaft bearing fails. They're picked up by a passing freighter, dropped off in Montreal, and a give up. They drive the Seep, and it's now back on land, of course, 900 miles overland to Halifax, and there they winter over. So they now spent a year trying to get to sea, and they haven't succeeded. Something's always gone wrong. Now, when they're in Halifax, the Seep finally gets named. As he works on her, he's bombarded by a popular radio commercial for a deodorant, which, by the way, I can remember very well. And the slogan was, don't be half safe, use Arid to be sure. And the press is constantly bugging him. What's the name of this contraption that you intend to sail across the ocean? He doesn't have a name for her. And finally, in sort of, well, I'm sure with his tongue in his cheek, with a certain wit, he says, her name is Half Safe.
So do we know, are they still married?
We will find out.
Okay, I am up.
Don't forget that he was born in 1912, so if they're still married, they're very old. Okay, so the first winter in Halifax stretches into the second winter in Halifax, because he doesn't have any money, and so he has to do odd jobs. He even ships out as an engineering officer on a small ship. And so finally, In 1950, it's now several years into the project, he sets off with his seasick wife and his brackish drinking water. And that's the passage that I opened with. Now, I don't have time to go into the details of his life at sea, but he's in an 18-foot Jeep, which is basically flat-bottom. It's towing a huge bladder of fuel behind it. It has this huge belly tank of fuel, and we can't say it really sails. What it does is it wallows. So it has. I've actually seen video of it, and because the Australian television later did something on him, and I saw the video. You can pick it up on YouTube. And this thing, in the smallest seaway, like a fairly common day out here, a calm day out here in Puget Sound, the thing is wallowing around like a piece of driftwood. Anyway, he has two, among his many other problems, he has two gargantuan problems, and I'm going to tell you about them both. The first one is that this Jeep engine, which is the original engine which came with the vehicle, was designed, it was engineered to run on leaded fuel, because that's what the military had. And it was designed to run at varying speeds, because Jeeps ran at varying speeds, and with varying loads. So the engine was heating up, it was cooling down, heating up, expanding, contracting, and that process kept it relatively decarbonized. It didn't have a lot of carbon, which would build up on the valves and the cylinder heads. But at sea, it was run at a constant 2,000 RPM through this little propeller, which he had installed. It didn't heat up. It didn't cool. It ran at a constant temperature. So it had to be decarboned. So he's at sea now, and his engine is carboning up. Here's how he writes about it. Decarbonizing the cylinder head took 5 hours. That may seem awfully slow to landbound mechanics, so I leaped to my own defense. To begin with, we couldn't afford to run off the cooling water into the bilge, and it took an hour to siphon it through the 3/16-inch drain cock into cans. Only half the cylinder head was exposed by the engine hatch. The other half was craftily tucked away under a ledge. I was working balanced on my stomach across the dashboard, with toes just touching the floor behind, head down, hands just reaching the work in front. The whole of the time the head was off the block, it had to be nursed. If set down anywhere, the motion of the Jeep was liable to hurl it through the side of the Jeep. The motion of the sea was liable to hurl it through the side of the Jeep. So there he is. He has the cylinder head off. He has his screwdriver. And he's scraping the valves and the top of the piston, decarbonizing this thing in this seaway. That was one problem. And it was done several times during the crossing. Second problem. This 385-gallon belly tank had to be filled with seawater as the fuel was used out of it. And you can see why that would be the case, because if it filled with air under there, it acts like a giant set of water wings, and it would push up on the Jeep, destabilize it completely. So it had to be filled with seawater. And he devised a system for doing that. Seawater would come in, there'd be a membrane between that and the fuel. And so eventually, the tank was filled with seawater, and it had to be jettisoned because he didn't want to be carrying 385 gallons of seawater across the Atlantic. Here's his description of the process. Remember, he's out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. I approached the job of dropping the belly tank, now full of seawater. I had hatched an ordered plan for releasing the straps, but it didn't work that way. When I had reduced them to two on one side and one on the other, there was sudden boom, like the gong of doom, and half-safe rolled viciously to 30 degrees and stayed there. Eleanor was almost pitched into the water. I'd been rather more tense than usual all through the act, and this shock fairly pumped me full of butterflies. I yelled to Eleanor to check the bilge and pump if it was necessary, and I dived to investigate. And what he found was that the remaining strap on one side had broken. It had corroded through. And so the tank was hanging entirely by the straps that attached to one side only, and that's what was destabilizing it. He said, when I realized this, the rest was simple. I dived to cut the remaining straps short against the tank. Down the tank plunged, edge first, smaller and smaller in the limpid water. There was no sense of it receding in distance. It merely shrank in size to a matchbox. So 31 days after leaving Halifax, they arrive in the Azores Islands, which is about two-thirds of the way to the Africa coast, where they intended to haul out and turn this thing into a land vehicle again. Weeks later, after having put Half Safe on display and charging 8 cents admission to see it, because they were perennially short of money, they set sail for the Canary Islands. More troubles. The motor cut out because there was water in the fuel. In a big storm, they lost the fuel tank they were towing. Remember I said there was a big bladder behind them. They lost that. So now they're short of fuel, and the fuel has seawater in it. The wind turns to a true hurricane. And here's Carlin on the storm, riding it out in this 18-foot amphibious jeep. At times, Half Safe was smashed and submerged by two or three breakers within 5 minutes. It might be half an hour before the next one came. Sometimes there was warning, sometimes not. Breaking some distance astern, the express train roar of the thundering white wall drowned even the constant blast of the spindrift and covered us tense and braced for the coming shock. Cowered us tense and braced for the coming shock. Wham! Whish! And it was gone. Breaking close behind, there was no warning before the deafening, stunning crash. Several times during these 2 days, I remember Crest breaking so close behind, virtually over her, that they hammered the jeep down with such violence as to leave Eleanor and me sitting in midair. A moment later, the seats were regained with a bone-rattling thump. The shocking violence of all these impacts was really quite indescribable. And literally incredible was the ability of the light superstructure to withstand them. But they survived, all three of them, Eleanor, Carlin, and Half Safe. And they reached the Canary Islands, they sailed to mainland Africa, and they landed at a place called Cape Juby, that's J-U-B-Y, in what was then Spanish Sahara, today it's Mauritania. Now, of course, when they got the jeep on the shore, and there was a good shingle shore for them to get it on. None of the undercarriage worked because it had been exposed to seawater for all of those days. So there on the shore, he redid the brakes, he redid the suspension, etc. And they set out overland. From Spanish Sahara, they drove to Morocco. They crossed, obviously, by water to Gibraltar. They drove through Spain and France. Then they drove up to Denmark and Sweden. Then they came back to France. They took her across the channel, putt. And on August 26, 1951, which is 13 months after they set sail from Halifax, they were in England.
That is quite remarkable, though. I was imagining it would take a lot longer than that, given the story.
Yeah. Well, he was able to make two or three knots across the Atlantic, and of course he was there for a couple months. And once the jeep got landbound again, and once they were able to, of course they had to cross the trackless Sahara, there wasn't any road going up there to Gibraltar. But once they got to Gibraltar, she was, you know, roadworthy at 50 miles an hour or something like that, so they could make good time. So what are the future? He's in England. It took him 2.5 years of redesign to rebuild Half Safe in England. Meanwhile, Eleanor had been put to work, actually with the United States Air Force, as a secretary. So she was bringing in some money, and they were able to scrape together enough for him to rebuild her. And this time, with the experience, of course, of having been in the Atlantic Ocean, he had new design ideas. And she looked much trimmer, I would say, when you see the pictures of her going back in the water with a more substantial superstructure, etc. Anyway, by June 54, she'd been sea-tested, ready to go again. It went back across the channel. They're now in continental Europe. And his book, Half Safe, closes with a sketch of their proposed itinerary. And this is his voice again. From Paris, our route lies overland to Calcutta via Istanbul, Damascus, Baghdad, Tehran, Kabul, and Delhi, by water to Rangoon, overland to Saigon via Bangkok, by sea and land to Alaska via the Philippines, Formosa, Okinawa, Japan, and the Aleutians, and finally by land to Montreal and New York. HalfSafe is now far better than ever she was, and only major disaster will prevent us from completing the round trip. But you may be sure that a brace of bulldozers couldn't persuade us to start a second circuit. So they set out. And the question is, did they make it around the world? Well, the answer to that is yes and no. He made it around the world. And he wrote a book called Half Safe Around the World, which picks up where the original volume that I mentioned, Half Safe, which just takes them as far as I've indicated, leaves off. But Eleanor didn't make it. Finally, in the Middle East, she couldn't take it any longer, and she bailed out. And I have no idea what happened to Eleanor. But notice this itinerary.
Eleanor was a saint, I'll say that.
Notice this itinerary they have. I mean, Istanbul, Damascus, Baghdad, Tehran, Kabul, and Delhi. I mean, how that resonates today.
Exactly.
You know, and this was the mid-50s, and you could do this. A crazy Australian with his half-crazed wife.
And you could cross all those borders and just,
Away they went. He picked up on the way two more male companions. One of them also bailed out, but one of them made it all the way to Canada with him. And when I saw this Australian on YouTube, when I saw this Australian broadcast in this show, this, by now an old guy, because the show was made only a few years ago, came on, and he talked about some of the adventures they had. It was really quite incredible. So they finally rolled into Montreal on May 12th, of 1958, he and the Jeep having completed this round-the-world voyage. So many years en route, but he made it. Ben Carlin himself died at the age of 69 in 1981, and I have no idea about Eleanor, but she was his age. My guess is that she's probably deceased. And Half Safe, however, lives on. And it is at the school, it was given eventually to the school that Ben Carlin went to when he was a boy, a public school. It's, again, in the video, you see the young boys in their uniforms. They roll Half Safe out onto the sound stage, and they talk about how Half Safe has become the motto of the school. And the school, it may be, probably it's in Latin, but they didn't give it in Latin, is never give up. So that's the story of Ben Carlin and his amphibious Jeep. And we now turn to a very, very different voyage. I've titled this A Modest Man and a Not So Modest Voyage Across the Atlantic. And this modest man's name was Robert Manry, M-A-N-R-Y. And this is how his book begins. His book is titled Tinkerbell. And of course, it was taken from Peter Pan, but it's spelled differently. Tinkerbell in Peter Pan is two words spelled just like it sounds. Tinkerbell, his boat, was spelled T-I-N-K-E-R-B-E-L-L-E, one word. Anyway, here's how his book begins. Even with shortened canvas, Tinkerbell rushed headlong through the darkness at about 7 knots, her top speed. Her spray-soaked sails strained against their fastenings as the relentless wind probed for some point of weakness that could be forced to give way. Every now and then a foaming wave cap slammed into her starboard side, sending up a geyser of spume and sloshing rivers of salt water back along her deck, half-filling her self-bailing cockpit. Under each blow of the wave, she lurched like a wounded doe, dipping to leeward with a tense stomach-churning heave. She told me, through her tiller, by the way she wanted to point closer to the wind, that she was unhappy, but I forced her to go on full tilt. My socks, canvas, shoes, feet, and lower halves of my trousers and legs were soaked, despite the waterproof outer suit. Rivulets from my sodden hair trickled across my face, down my neck, stabbing icily at my back, making me wince. My hands were puckered and swollen from prolonged saturation. They hurt, especially the tips of the fingers and thumbs, which made untying knots and adjusting the sheets painful tasks. Salt water sores on my buttocks turn the necessity of sitting into pure misery. So that's how the book begins. It's one of my absolutely favorite books about the sea. The man who wrote it, I'm going to tell you about him in just a minute, was a hugely literate guy. And this thing is this book is absolutely lyrical in places. And because he's such a good writer, such a thoughtful guy, I'm actually going to read some fairly big chunks of it. Anyway, the man we're talking about, Robert Manray, was at the time of his great adventure, which took place in 1965, a copy editor at the Cleveland Plain Dealer, which is at that time certainly a very fine newspaper in Cleveland. He'd worked there for 12 years. He'd been born and raised in India by missionary parents. He'd been an infantryman in Europe during the Second World War. He was married with two children, a boy and a girl, and lived a quiet life in a suburb of Cleveland. He was shy and somewhat reclusive, very devoted to his family. And in 1958, he bought a small used boat for $160 because he loved sailing and wanted to share that hobby with his wife and kids. And everything we know about Manray and everything that shows in his book is he would walk into sort of any crowd at the mall. You would never pick him out, nor did his lifestyle, the suburban lifestyle, a modest income, but a very solid job at that time. Nothing to make him out of the ordinary.
No, not at all.
Okay. Now, the boat he bought was a 30-year-old, 13.5-foot lapstrake centerboard sloop built by the Maine Base Old Town Canoe Company. I think many older people will recognize Old Town Canoes. I believe they still exist in some kind of plastic format. This was the premier canoe building company in the country at that time. But they also built small sailboats. And the small sailboats were built very much like the canoes, which is to say they had steam-bent ribs, they were round bottom, they were handsome little craft. But, as I say, small, 13.5 feet. The boat was in poor shape with multiple broken ribs, gaping cracks in her planking, and quite a bit of dry rot. He set about rebuilding her, eventually adding a tiny cabin, a self-bailing cockpit, foam flotation, and numerous safety features. As I mentioned, she was named after Tinkerbell in Peter Pan. And for the next 6 years after he rebuilt her, Manray and his family trailed and sailed this little boat around the Midwest when he had vacation, sailing her on lakes, basically, and reservoirs. Hmm. Now, from his teenage years, Manray had harbored dreams of someday making a long ocean voyage. It was sort of a Walter Mitty kind of thing. Here he was sitting at his desk at the Cleveland Plain Dealer, correcting other people's prose and editing it, and dreaming of a long ocean voyage. Now, the dream was fanned by reading Slocum's Voyage, which we've talked about, sailing along around the world. And he also knew about Ben Carlin and Half Safe. And although there's no evidence that this is the case, my guess is that when he read about Ben Carlin, he was thinking, well, if that guy can do it in an amphibious Jeep, I can do it in this lovely little sailboat, which is a proper craft, not a sea-growing craft necessarily, but a proper craft. So when he got Tinkerbell, and she proved to be very, very seaworthy, particularly with the modifications he made, his dream crystallized around a plan to sail her single-handedly across the Atlantic. Needless to say, he didn't tell his colleagues at the Plain Dealer about that, but he did tell his wife, Virginia, and he eventually told his children. And so finally, after taking leave from his job, he set sail from Falmouth, Massachusetts on June 1st, 1965. He was 47 years old, and he had had little Tinkerbell already for 7 years when he set out. Now, I'm going to have to really compress his voyage. Many, many interesting stories, again, because he writes so well. But the trip took 78 days from Falmouth, Massachusetts to Falmouth, Cornwall, in England. He decided to go from Falmouth to Falmouth. And here's a brief catalog of some of his adventures. He was knocked overboard 6 times by large waves. He was, of course, tied on with a lifeline, or he would have died. So he was always able to get back aboard. And the way he'd configured Tinkerbell, she was self-righting. In other words, a knockdown is when your mast goes all the way over to the water. So 90 degrees, you're on your side. You're out of the boat. But she was self-bailing. And when she came back up, the water in the very small cockpit would eventually drill out. He was able to get himself back on the boat, and off he went. His worst breakage was the rudder broke twice. He was a careful guy, as one might expect a copy editor to be. And so he had a spare rudder. And then he was eventually able, when the spare rudder broke as well, between the two broken rudders and some other things, he was able to make yet a third rudder. He was visited at sea a surprising number of times by freighters. Russian trawlers, a United States submarine, picked him up on radar and surfaced right next to him, scaring the hell out of him, you could imagine. And, of course, all of these people inquired whether he was in big trouble.
How'd you get here?
Yeah, right. Assuming he had been blown offshore. And every time he replied, no, I'm not. But I would really appreciate it if you would give me an accurate plotting of where I am, a reading of where I am. Because he had a sextant. Very hard to take accurate readings off a 13-foot boat bouncing around the middle of the ocean. And, of course, they would almost always pass him some food or some delicacy. And he wanted the Coast Guard to be informed of where he was. And, of course, the Coast Guard then informed his wife. So he was in touch, but on this random basis, when there was his encounter at sea. He had extended periods of hallucinations brought on by lack of sleep and the uppers that he was taking to stay awake. He was taking Dexedrine. And here's a partial description of one such hallucination. The stories go on, actually, for pages of the hallucination. They're very, very interesting because of the actual nature of the hallucination itself. Not just that he had them, but the form they took. So here's his voice. The incident was so unusual, so completely different from any earlier happening in my life, that I have great difficulty in describing it satisfactorily, especially for anyone who has not had a similar experience. I suppose, in a sense, I went off the deep end, out of my mind, into a neverland where real things and dream things existed side by side without distinction, where reality and imagination merged, leaving no hints of which was which. I've attributed what took place to lack of sleep and stay-awake pills, but anxiety and, even more likely, loneliness, as my mother had feared, may have contributed to it too. Like a person in a hypnotic trance, I simply began seeing and hearing things that weren't really there. I became aware gradually that I was not alone. Someone, a man, was on Tinkerbell with me. This man had no face that I can recall, nor can I remember what he wore, although his clothing seemed to be appropriate for sailing. He was a quiet man with very little to say, and he was friendly. At first I reciprocated with equal friendliness, but later on his presence became inexpressibly annoying, intolerable. Now, one of the things that he treats of in his book, and I found this actually quite moving, and it's something that someone like Ben Carlin, number one, never would have thought of and never could have expressed. And that was that he had more than faith in Tinkerbell. He had a love affair with Tinkerbell.
Yeah.
And although swept by waves, knocked down, etc., as I mentioned, she always righted herself and always protected him. And here he writes about her. I had tremendous faith in my companion, my friend, Tinkerbell. She was the main reason for my serenity. A voyage made by a solitary person is sometimes called a single-handed voyage or a solo voyage, but neither of these terms gives proper credit to the most important factor in any voyage, the boat. Far from being a solo, a one-man voyage is a kind of maritime duet in which the boat plays the melody and its skipper plays the harmonic counterpoint. The performances of the boat and the skipper are both important, undeniably, but if it comes to making a choice between the two, the decision must be in favor of the boat, for there have been a few honest-to-goodness solo voyages, and these have been made by boats, not men. which says what kind of guy he is. Now, he wasn't aware of it, but because these messages were coming back to the United States, the media had picked up that this guy off the coffee desk at the Cleveland Plain Dealer was going across the Atlantic in a 13.5-foot boat, which Manry barely recognized was the smallest boat ever to cross the Atlantic. But it was the smallest boat up until that time ever to cross the Atlantic. So there was a media frenzy building up, which he was not aware of. And this media frenzy turned into a media circus even before he arrived in England. As I mentioned, news of this voyage had reached both sides of the Atlantic, and when he was still a week away from landing in England, a very resourceful TV reporter from Cleveland hired a boat and went out with his cameraman to meet Manry at sea. He came to get the story, and he got it, and he got... it was celluloid film footage of Manry at sea. And later, he's still at sea, that the Cleveland Plain Dealer, which is his newspaper, has flown his wife and his children to Falmouth to greet him. I mean, he expected to land, of course, alone and eventually go home and see them. So with the cameras whirring, Virginia also comes out to sea on a trawler and meets them while at sea. So they have a reunion at sea. He's still several days away from landing. And, of course, you can imagine how this played, on TV news back in the United States. So he's already famous, and he hasn't even landed yet. When he finally lands on August 17th, he's greeted by a huge flotilla of ships, and I've seen a picture of this. I mean, it looks like the America's Cup. He's surrounded by hundreds of ships and boats, dozens of journalists, and a crowd on shore of 50,000 people waiting for him.
He has really captured people's imagination here.
And he hasn't done any of it. It's all been cooked up by the media itself. Yeah. He's traveled 3,200 miles alone for 78 days, and now he's at the center of this feeding frenzy.
Had he not worked for a newspaper, who's to say what would have happened?
Who knows? And here's how he writes about it. Most of what happened after that, he's talking about landing, is blurred in my mind. I was too stunned to comprehend fully or remember. I do recall, though, that every boat and ship in the harbor let go with its horn or whistle and shook the whole waterfront with reverberating sound as the crowd yelled. Royal Air Force Shackletons, that's a big four-engine airplane, flew overhead in wig-wagging salutes, and a band on the quay, I heard later it was the St. Stithian Silver Band, played the Star-Spangled Banner and the Stars and Stripes Forever. I hugged and kissed Virginia, that's his wife, Robin and Douglas, those are his children, and then met Samuel A. Hooper, mayor of Falmouth, who looked most impressive in his scarlet robes and golden chain of office. He welcomed me to the city, and I apologize for delaying his vacation. Hooper was going to go off on vacation, but when he heard that Manry was coming...
Don't miss an opportunity.
Yeah, couldn't miss that one. Then I knelt and kissed the stones of the quay in thanksgiving for a safe passage across the ocean and in gratitude for the warm welcome I was receiving. And I'm going to close with a couple of longish passages from the very end of his book in which he reflects on his voyage. One of the implications of these musings was that my voyage in Tinkerbell had been prompted by an itch and was itself a form of scratching. That was true. The voyage was something I simply had to do, had wanted to do for a long, long time. In fact, I'd wanted to do it so intensely and for such a long time that my natural timidity, the basic Walter Mitty, Casper, milquetoast cast of my character, had finally been beefed up with a fair-sized dash of Captain Ahab. And that's when planning for the cruise had got underway in earnest.
He's a guy with a real a strong sense of his interior world.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And a really articulate. He learned a lot when he was doing that editing.
Yeah.
About
basically
language.
A shy guy. He continues later. What had the voyage achieved besides making my dreams a reality? I think probably the most important thing it had done for me was to enable me to stand back, away from human society ashore, and look at life for a little while from a new perspective. In a sense, the Atlantic Ocean had been a personal Walden pond on which I had lived simply, in close communication with nature, confronted by elemental dangers and necessities. It certainly had not been a place for trivialities, and I think perhaps that fact may have done something to make me a better person inside than I had been before. Anyway, I hope it did. Although I was lonely and discouraged at times, my primary feeling was of contentment and peace. My boat was my dearest companion, and though the wind and sea were sometimes my adversaries, they were mostly friendly, and even when they were not, they behaved with straightforward honesty according to their inherent natures. To know them was to respect them. There was one hugely wonderful thing to be said for the sea. It was always the sea, constantly, perpetually, invariably, uniformly, eternally the sea. It was the sea and nothing else. It couldn't dissimulate. It couldn't say one thing while thinking another. It couldn't flatter you and turn your head. There wasn't a treacherous or dishonest wave in its whole massive body. Another thing I liked about the sea was that I could pit myself against it without fear of injuring another human being. Nothing I did mattered at all to the sea. Nothing I did could hurt it in the least. But in the hurly-burly of life ashore, where people were pitted against one another in a furious scramble for success, it was almost impossible to avoid hurting others or being hurt by them. And he actually continues with another passage, which I'm not going to read, in which he talks about his view of the nature of society in the United States in 1965, where the poor and the underprivileged, and what he says, the less prepared is the word, the phrase that he used, those less prepared have immense problems about which we seem to be able to do almost nothing.
Wow, that's a. Yeah. Those are words filled with a lot of dignity.
Yeah, yeah, tremendously
people.
Dignified.
Language. Yeah.
Now, as in the case of Half Safe, what happened to Man Ray, his wife Virginia, and Tinkerbell? This is not a happy story. Well, it begins in a very wonderful way. Tinkerbell, Man Ray, his wife Virginia, the two children Robin and Douglas, and and Tinkerbell, as I've said, they were all put on the Queen Mary, courtesy
even
of the plane
boat.
Dealer. Even the boat. Yeah, the boat was so tiny. and brought back to the United States and eventually to Cleveland. But tragically, Virginia was killed in an automobile accident in May of 1969. And then, less than 2 years later, age 52, Manry died of a massive heart attack. So shortly after the end of the voyage, within a handful of years, both parents were gone. The kids were orphaned. Manry's sister came to live in the house until the kids were of age. His record, which I mentioned, of taking the smallest boat across the Pacific, was broken in 1968 by an airline pilot who sailed a 6-foot boat across. Now, this was a stunt. This was a guy who was looking for the Guinness Book of Records. And to my delight, he wrote a book. All these people write books. To my delight, a few years later, it was broken, that record was broken, by someone who had a boat an inch and a half shorter. So really, the magnificent of Man Ray's voyage, the magnificent, was trivialized into this kind of stunt making. Who could go? And I'm sure I haven't paid much attention, but there's probably someone who's broken that record by 3/4 of an inch or something like that. But it's all meaningless. It's completely right. Meaningless. It has no meaning. Whereas, of course, Man Ray's voyage, I think, has a great deal
absolutely
of meaning. So only little Tinkerbell remains. And she is in a museum in Cleveland. I think it's the Western Case Western Reserve Society Museum. I haven't been to Cleveland in, I don't know, decades and decades and decades. But if I ever go, you can be sure I'm going to hunt down the little Tinker Bell and sort of pay homage to her. And I highly recommend this book. I believe the Lopez Library may have it.
But what is the title of this book again?
It's Tinkerbell.
Tinkerbell.
And as
okay,
I said, spelled T-I-N-K-E-R-B-E-L-L-E, all one word. It is just a wonderful read. And the photographs that are in it and the line drawings and things like this give a very, very clear picture of what he was, what he was up against, and how he addressed these problems. It's a very uplifting book, even if one isn't directly interested in this kind of voyaging.
Yeah.
So,
well, I'm going to the library next, and I'll be checking out if it's there.
Yeah.
So,
and if not, obviously they'll get it on interlibrary loan. It was reissued. Of course, it went out of print, but it was reissued some X years ago. I don't know, know when. So we leave Mr. Carlin and Mr. Manry and small boat voyages across the Atlantic, and not a bad place to leave our strange and wonderful world at this time.
Absolutely. I think quite a magnificent place with an ordinary man living an ordinary life with an extraordinary dream.
Exactly. That he was able to fulfill in a lovely manner.
And yet with humbleness and a perspective of his place in the in both the human society and in the world.
Yeah.
That's very inspiring.
Absolutely. Yeah. I wanted to end on that note because it is, let's say that Ben Carlin is the strange side of it and Robert Manry is the wonderful side of the strange and wonderful world.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and it's with some sadness and that I say goodbye to you, Richard, for we don't know for how long. I can't imagine we won't be on the air at some point with something. But who knows?
Who knows?
Future is yet to be seen.
Okay. Thank you,
Carol. So have wonderful journeys. I know you have several planned for the winter and have some wonderful journeys. And I can't thank you enough for the time. You know, Richard comes in here every week with, I don't know how many pages this is this week.
This one's about nine.
About nine. And so I'd say anywhere from 6 to 10 pages of an outline. It's just an outline, but he does read very carefully from when he's reading from the voice of a book, of a person who's written a book. But the rest of it is an outline that he uses to speak from, and clearly a lot of time and thought goes into every one of these programs, and it's very apparent as you listen to it. And we will be replaying, as I said earlier, this series beginning the third Monday in November, and we'll go back to the Antarctic and go from there. So, again, thanks so very much, Richard.
My pleasure.
And a good voyage.